Succession number 9476, reel number 5.
And what we actually used to do, we used to lie alongside one another, and we used to put our putties round our legs like that and keep warm. You know, that's what we did. We kept ourselves warm. And I mean, so far as we were concerned, it was quite a natural sort of thing to do. No overtones of any sort, like they would have today.
So travelling to the seacoast was a problem.
It was quite a problem, yeah. And you used to arrive filthy and dirty, yeah. And you perhaps go to a Stanley or somewhere to try and get a meal before you went, and you're in this dirty condition. Used to feel shocking, but you couldn't help it. You just had to put up with it, and you didn't. You weren't clean or presentable until you got home and had a bath and put clean clothes on.
Was travel in Britain much easier, long distance travel?
Well, we used to arrive, I can't remember where we used to arrive, but I know we used to get the King's Cross, and we invariably arrived in the small hours of the morning. Unfortunately, the chap who was on leave with me lived adjacent to the Newcastle Central Station. And then at 2 o'clock in the morning, I used to go to his house and stay overnight, and then go down the following morning home. So that problem was all right.
So roughly speaking, out of 14 days, how many days at home did you actually have?
Well, roughly speaking, you would have a good 10 full days. 10 full days, yes. And it was quite good, that. You see, you had some fellows in the trenches that didn't have any leave for 3 years.
What did you feel about going back?
Not worried about it at all. Going on. But when the opportunity came to get out, of course, we were quite pleased. Would have gone back quite cheaply. But it so happened, it was very fortuitous, that our leave expired the day after. We got to know that the riot had happened. Mm.
Yes, well, we'll come to the second leave that you had, which was actually took place after the armistice, when we look at the armistice later on. If we go back to France now, did you stay at that chateau throughout the war?
We were on the move.
How long were you at the chateau for then?
Only a few months. Well, this was the position. The 9th Wing was not attached to an army unit like the 4th or 5th Army, and we moved up and down the Western Front in accordance with military operations. Where there was going to be an offensive, we moved there in preparation for it. And if there was a new pressure somewhere and they couldn't contain it, the 9th Wing moved down. We were a mobile unit, an emergency unit, shall we say, a contingency unit. We were the fire brigade.
Is that how you regarded yourself at the time?
No, just accepted us. Moving about, no. Well, no sense of superiority.
Did you understand the significance of your moving about from one place to another? Did you?
Not really. No. You see, at that age, 18, your best flyers were 17 and 18 and 19. They weren't conscious of what was going on around them, like an adult was. And to them, it was a form of excitement or pleasure. Some of these 17 years old used to relish it, you know, fighting. Well, they hadn't grown up. They were still mature boys, or immature men. But They had no fear at all. There's Rhys Davison. I've got all the names here of all the, I've got the whole names of all the 56 squadron. And I made a special study of 56 squadron. Why? I don't know. And I never did with anything else.
Did you actually ever meet any of the pilots?
I never met any of the servicemen at any time. The headquarters was always well away in a safe zone. No. We used to see them coming in. We used to see them coming in, going to the orderly office, receiving instructions where they had to go. And then the tenders from the squadrons used to come to the headquarters and pick up these men. And then you used to see these young fellows with their brand new wings up, brand new uniform, brand new sound drum, everything brand new, smart. Then we would go back to the squadron. And some of these boys didn't last 24 hours. This commentator, I forget his name now, I'll forget the name, he said the average life at the most was 3 weeks.
Mm. Which was something that you were not aware of at the time.
Oh, no. That's a flying man.
Mm. When some of the pilots that you've mentioned, like Ball and Rhys and so on, were very famous at the time, weren't they? They became household names in Britain. When they died, what effect did that have on the Ninth Wing? Were you aware that they had died? Did you know?
You see, I was on duty when it all happened. I've got it all down here. They went out, 56 Squadron. Now, 56 Squadron. On May the 7th, I've got the details of this. The squadron consisting of... Air flight. There were three men in air flight: Captain Ball, Maxwell, and Nags. And then B flight by Captain Crowe, Mustons, Rhys Davis, Leach. And C flight we had Menzies, Melville, Lewis, and Hodge. Now, Lewis is still alive. He was 90. I don't know if he still. He lived to the age of 90, and he wrote several books about it. Now then, the squadron went out at 5:30. I wasn't on duty when they went out, but I was on duty when they were expected back. And it was known there had been a disaster. It was said they had met the flying circus, and out of the squadron 12, 30, out of 15 men that went out, and that evening only 5 returned, and one of those who hadn't returned was Captain Ball, and no one knew what had happened. The other men in due course turned up in hospitals, crashed, killed. But Captain Ball, no one knew what happened. And all who knew was, and Lewis reported it, going into a cloud with Captain Ball. And when he came out the other side, Ball wasn't there. And it would appear that Ball... Later we learned, it wouldn't appear, we learned definitely later, after the war finished, I learned that he had landed upside down in the German lines, apparently out of petrol. And he landed near a farmhouse. And the young lady came out and lifted him out of, and he had a broken back. And he died in her house. Quite recently I've received a full account of a friend of mine who was in that village in Alastair and got all the details about Captain Ball's funeral. Mm.
which of course was things that you were not really aware of at the time we're talking about. But what I was interested in was the effect of someone with which people held in such high regard and made him into a hero would have on people who, although you'd never talked to him, might have had on you as a member of the same unit in which he was working. Can you remember how the news hit you?
Well, so far as the unit was concerned, it was commonplace for the disappear. You see, as I said, you saw these boys come in, and some of them only lasted one day. Now at night time, you see, I was on duty, and I remember going into the old man and filling in the form. That's what the form was. I just drafted that all 2 years ago.
Could you describe the form to me, please?
Well, the form was an ordinary sheet of plain foolscap, and it was ruled horizontally. And there was a departure, and then we had a section for the pilot, and the name of his machine, a number. Type of machine is number, and then we had the column where we recorded his return, and then at the end we had quite a large space for the combat report. So as each squadron, as each flight of a squadron went out, a form was filled in, a form was commenced and filled in the course of the day, and at the end of the end of the day, these things were collected and down to the staff section.
We talked earlier on about you moving from place to place.
Yeah.
In support of the squadrons as they were needed along the line. Can you remember any of the places that you were actually moved to and the dates when they?
Yes, I can remember the details of one or two. But I have a record which mentions about 8 places, most of which I cannot remember any details. Now, we're at Fiend Villas. We were there about 3 months. And then we moved down to near Saint-Omer, Boisingham. And we were there about 9 months, and then we moved down a place called Champion.
Have you any idea what years we're talking about in these?
Yes, I can tell you the years. Fiend Villas, we were there from the 19th of February to the 31st of the 5th. What year is that? That's five.
May.
31st of May. Then from the 31st of May, we went down to 31st of May 1917. We went down to Boisingham and were there to the 6th of February 1918. That was a long spell, that.
Can you remember anything about Boisingham?
We were in huts there. It's adjacent to Saint-Omer.
Were the conditions worse or better than at the chateau, as far as you were concerned?
Conditions were reasonable. I wouldn't say they were better or worse. Or just no. Just we're at a stage where we just accepted anything, and we're there for all that time. I remember we were there when we had extra personnel. We had a fuller phone installed, and
yes, you mentioned the fuller phone earlier on.
Yeah, and on one occasion there was a message to be sent by fuller phone to a squadron. And the squadron never received it, with disastrous results. Because one of the armies, I think it was the 5th Army, had a flight of RE-8s going out on bombing and reconnaissance flight. And they wanted the protection of a fighter squadron. And the 9th Wing had to supply the fighter squadron, and according to the telegraphist who worked it, he said he sent the message on the phone to the squadron, and the squadron never received it. Consequently, you had a flight of RA8s unprotected, and the Germans brought the lot down, and there was hell on about it, and rightly so. All sorts of experts visiting the headquarters to find out why this Fullerphone ceased to function.
Was it ever resolved? Was the problem solved?
Never resolved. The weather report, of course, an essential thing. It was a most primitive arrangement, so primitive you can hardly believe it. At daybreak, one of the squadrons would send up a single aeroplane, and you knew he was in view of where you were, and you knew that when he reached a certain height he was going to go backwards and forwards, which is 10,000 feet. And an inexperienced person like me had to judge what speed he was doing and the way the wind was blowing.
You actually had to observe the aircraft.
You could observe the aircraft and you're going backwards and forwards.
How did you do that then?
Pardon?
How did you make the judgment?
Well, you knew if the wind was behind him, he was going faster than what he was on there. It was just a case of visual operation. It was a stupid arrangement.
Yes, I'm not quite sure I understand. How did you measure the wind speed?
You didn't, you just guessed it.
Well, this must have been at ground level.
You were ground level.
Yes.
And you saw this thing moving.
Mm-hmm.
And you had been watching planes for a bit, you could assess them. And you knew when there was a headwind. And you knew he was going slower.
Oh, I see.
He was going faster. And that was all.
And then what would you do with that information?
Somebody would ask you what it was like, what the conditions were, what did you observe this morning? And you would repeat that. I can't see what value it was, but that's what happened.
Did you have any other duties related directly to flying conditions?
No, I can tell you about night flyers though. We can come to that later. How they used to land. I haven't told you about that, have I?
No, were you involved in that at all?
No. I used to hear all these things. The night flying was a different operation altogether. And there was a plane, the BE-2C. It was dead slow. In that sense, you could fly at 50 miles an hour and take your controls off, and the plane put fuel on its way. And it was dead quiet. You couldn't hear it. And they used this for night reconnaissance and dropping spies. And the expert was a Brooklyn's man. The expert was, as I said, Captain Woodhouse. And he used to take the spies over. And when he received the ground signal, he knew where to drop them.
What sort of signal would it be from the ground?
Flushed. The French underground movement would be on the airplane, able to go. On one occasion, it was taken an English spy, a man to act as a spy, over. And this fella was given the instruction to jump. He had a parachute on. And this fella lost his nerve and attacked Woodhouse. And there was a fight in midair. And Woodhouse had to shoot him, push him overboard. And landing these aeroplanes in the dark was quite a problem. And I didn't see it happen, but I was told how they did it. They had some magnesium strips along the wings of the aeroplane. Photographic strips, flash light. And as they came down, they used to switch us on, and these things used to light up, they used to help them. But if it was safe and there was nothing about, they used to have lights on either side. But if there's any, you know, if there's any more aircraft about, they couldn't switch his lights on, otherwise they're going to be bombed. The airdrome was going to be bombed.
Before we move on from Wasingham, are there any more incidents that we can perhaps look
yes,
at?
Yes, I remember when we were there, we heard the strains of Colonel Bogey, the Regimental March, and we went out to see what it was. And here was the advance group of an infantry battalion that had been on a forced march. And these men were in the most exhausted condition. And they told us a lot of their colleagues had fallen, collapsed by the wayside. So they mobilised all their transport and went out and picked all these boys up.
What was your feelings about that?
Well, of course, we were quite perturbed about it. Oh, yes. I say, if I'd been much older, we'd be much more emotionally more, but we realised what was up and we did what we could to help.
Do you know why they've been on a forced march out in France?
Yeah. They were on the march to relieve a particular point. They wanted some reinforcement somewhere. No way to get them there to march them. You remember, horse transport was still in vogue. We had as much horse transport. In fact, the only real motor transport was with the flying corps. And we had Lelins and Crossleys and Harley Davidson motorbikes. But we were far better from transport, because we were better equipped than anybody.
Did you have any horses?
We didn't have any horses in the flying corps. Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, I remember the Crossley tenders all painted green, and Harley Davidson motorbikes. And these motorbikes, you know, during the summer months, there was a thing called a Maybug. A big beetle, nearly an inch long, very slow in flight. And our fellows were riding through and hitting these things, hitting large stings on their brows. These flying Maybugs, they call them Maybugs, were quite a menace to the motorcyclists. It was a certain time of the year when I was in the migrating, they were just taking wing, or I don't know if they were in the breeding season or what. But these Maybugs were a down distance to the Harley Davidson motorcycles. I remember them pretty well.
Did you have any access to this transport?
Me?
Yeah.
Any access to it?
Yeah.
No. No. If a house cross tender was going in for rations,
you could take a lift with that.
No access to that. No.
Well, I would like to return now to the offensive, the German breakthrough in March 1918. When were you first aware of this?
I can't remember the dates at all, but I think it was early March 1918, and we were told to pack up and get a move on, and we didn't know what was happening really. I know all that happened at the wing headquarters was there's a series of Leyland lorries arrived, all the gear was packed into it, and the youngsters and other boys and myself, we were pushed in the back of a lorry, and we lay there and rested and slept and ate, and off we went. And to us it was a form of adventure, and the fact that it was a breakthrough, we didn't appreciate the what it meant at all. We were on the move, and we went from place to place. I can't remember the places, but I know we only stayed there for a very, very short time. There was no organisation. I can't remember any organisation whatsoever. Just that we were on the move all the time.
When you say there was no organisation, what do you mean by that?
I mean, we didn't stop and perform as a wing headquarters. We just, like gypsies, were in transit, and we moved. We just stayed, and then we moved, and then we stayed, and then we moved. We eventually came to, I forget now where it was.
when you stop, then you just stop to sort of.
We just stopped in the village, just stopped by the road, and stopped in the country anywhere.
But no, you didn't set up any sort of communication centre.
Not at all. No communication whatsoever.
What would you say the atmosphere was amongst the headquarters staff as you were moving there?
Well, we were in the back of a lorry, detached from everything and everyone. We never saw anybody. We didn't know what was going on. To us, it was a form of excitement, really. We had no duties. We just played about and filled the time on the best way we could by sleeping and eating and thoroughly enjoying ourselves. It's as bland as that. You read about these retreats, what's involved. Well, here we were. I remember being at school reading about the retreat from Moscow and Napoleon and all that. And here we were actually in a retreat. And it was fun.
Can you remember the first place that you actually formally set up headquarters and stayed there?
I have a recollection of Hayden. We were adjacent to Hayden. We had stayed in a village and occupied a very large chateau. Yes, the signal office, I remember, was in the courthouse. We were surrounded by harness and strappings belonging to the traps and carriages. And we had the signal office there. In the village, we were made welcome. And the villagers all provided us with coffee and eggs and chips, pomme de terre avec oeuf for 1 franc, and one or two of the farmhouses where there were some very handsome young ladies, and the boys were very much attached to this, but their parents kept their eye on them. I remember that very well. It wasn't the young boys that were interested, it was the elder men. And when we were at Hayden, there was a nunnery in Hayden, and the nuns sent word that if I wanted any linen seen to,